I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Gloucester, Massachusetts has been in the news lately, but a spike in teen pregnancies is just one of the many problems in America's oldest fishing port, as we'll hear today. But first, today, 5 years after the U.S.-led invasion, Iraq began a tentative process to open its oil fields, the world's third largest. International oil companies haven't done business in Iraq since Saddam Hussein came to power in the 1970s. The Bush administration had promised that profits from the oil fields would pay for the war in Iraq and the country's reconstruction, but those fields have been underperforming. Today's New York Times reports that American officials have been advising Iraqis on the wording of the contracts that were supposed to be awarded today. Andrew Kramer of the Times joins us on the line. And Andrew, what is the importance of the announcement today, the beginning of the process of opening the oil fields?
Well, we were expecting to have an announcement today of agreements from the ministry to really bring in the first commercial work for oil majors in Iraq in many, many years. Now, that announcement wasn't made today. Instead, they announced another round of bidding to bring companies in the future.
These are the long-term contracts. Are these going to be bid contracts, the ones that come 1 or 2 years down the road?
Yes, they will be open bidding contracts. Many companies will be able to compete. I believe there are 41 companies now on the list that are qualified, including companies from China, Russia, and India.
Now, with the long-term contracts, we understand Iraqi officials are stipulating some terms that international bidders have to meet. What are those terms?
The terms include that the companies hire local employees, that they find a local partner to work with, and that they also have in their program some contribution to the social development of the region they'll be working in.
But to the probably more controversial short-term contracts, which were supposed to be no bid, these were going to be awarded to companies, why do you think they weren't announced today?
Well, it's not quite clear. The explanation from the ministry is that the companies and the Iraqi ministry couldn't agree on the terms, including the issue of whether the companies would be paid in cash or in oil.
Well, as you reported today, American advisors have been helping draft the language and the contracts. And here in the U.S., critics of the Bush administration say these short-term no-bid contracts for U.S. allied companies prove that oil was the whole reason for the war. Is there perhaps some politics involved in today's delay?
Well, I think that would be speculation, but I certainly wouldn't exclude that. Iraqis are very sensitive about Western access to their oil fields, as are most petroleum exporting countries. In Iraq, it's particularly sensitive because of sectarian tensions over how the oil money will be divided, because most of the oil is in Shiite areas and in Kurdish areas rather than in the Sunni areas.
Well, what is the status of the Iraqi oil revenue sharing law that the Bush administration has long been pushing the Iraqi government to complete? Where does it stand?
It's stalled in Parliament. Various parties haven't been able to reach an agreement on that law.
And if passed, would it regulate these contracts in any way?
Yes, it would. It would require that contracts be put out for open tender, and it would also regulate the type of contract that can be offered to oil companies, with the most lucrative and sought-after type of contract is the production sharing agreement that gives companies a claim not exactly of ownership, but of rights to a certain amount of the reserves in the ground. And that will only be offered to technically challenging fields and areas that haven't been explored yet, where Iraq needs the technology from the companies.
There must be a big push in the Bush administration to make something happen in Iraq and the oil fields, given the high price of gas and fuel in this country.
I think that there certainly is. The policy of the U.S. government pretty much everywhere in the world is to increase the output of oil and increase supply. This is true in the Caspian Basin, in places like Venezuela, and they would encourage the Russians to increase production, for example. To think that the policy would be something different in Iraq would be unusual. At the same time, they're very reluctant to discuss what exactly is being done to encourage Iraq to increase its output because of the criticism that any direct meddling in Iraq's oil policy would be seen as a sign that the war had led to Western oil investment in Iraq, which is a concern in the Arab world and also in the United States.
That's Andrew Kramer, reporter for The New York Times, speaking to us from Moscow. The city of Gloucester, Massachusetts has been in the news lately. You may have heard about a spike in teen pregnancies at the high school. Gloucester was also the setting of the book and film A Perfect Storm, based on the real tragedy of the sinking of the fishing boat the Andrea Gale in 1991. But you may not know that T.S. Eliot, Edward Hopper, and Winslow Homer all lived in Gloucester at one time, or that in the 1970s there were 300 commercial trawlers based there, and now there are but a handful.
It took 400 years to build this culture, and it could all be lost in a few decades. Today in Gloucester, an old proverb has a new twist. They now say, if you give a man a fish, you feed him. If you teach a man to fish, he will starve.
That's Mark Kurlansky. He's written the history of Gloucester in the new book, The Last Fish Tale, The Fate of the Atlantic, and Survival in Gloucester, America's oldest fishing port and the most original town. And Mark joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
For those people outside of our area, you know, here in Boston, we love Gloucester, just north of Boston. But could you describe it and distinguish it from other places on the eastern coast people might have heard of?
Gloucester is the oldest fishing port in the United States, founded as a fishing station in 1623. And for all of this time, it has been completely focused on commercial fishing. And everything about the town is connected to commercial fishing. It's why so many artists went there. They went there to paint the harbor and the fishing scene. And it's the reason why there is the particular combination of ethnic backgrounds that there is, the people who came there for the fishing industry, the Irish from Maritime Canada and the Portuguese from the Azores and the Sicilians and Jews from the New York garment industry who went there to make fishing clothes. One of the peculiarities of Gloucester is that it's a man-made island. It's connected to the rest of Cape Ann by a tiny little, maybe 5-foot strip of land that was cut through for shipping in the 1600s. So it is, in effect, an island, and it has very much an island mentality. Gloucester people consider themselves separate not only from Massachusetts but from the rest of Cape Ann.
Which is the sort of the area of Massachusetts they're on. And it's just, I mean, we can't stress enough, it's just a few feet, but you talk about people who have never crossed the bridge from Gloucester to the rest of Massachusetts.
Right, and there's always this sense of going into foreign territory when you do cross the Annisquam River and you're in Massachusetts. One of the effects of this is that it was always an unusually self-sufficient fishery. They built their own ships from local forests, and they made their own nets, and they made their own fishing clothing, the oilskins, and it was always this world unto itself.
Well, and what was so appealing to artists, this authenticity that drew people to Gloucester, was a very tough life for people who had to live there and be the fishermen.
That has shaped the town also. You know, there's a famous statue there with the names of 5,000 Gloucestermen who have been lost at sea. And historians think that that's only half the real number of names, that have gotten lost in the 1600s and 1700s. So it's a place that has lived with tremendous tragedy, sometimes hundreds of people being lost in one gale one night. You know, Winslow Homer poignantly did paintings of the way women and children used to stare out at the horizon, hoping to see ships coming back. It's a very hard way to lose your loved ones. All you know is that they don't make it back.
Although sometimes they do, and it adds to the legions of Gloucester stories. You said they're very particular about what's a Gloucester story, and things are so Gloucester. It's used as, what would that be, an adjective? Yeah, things are so Gloucester.
It's a very Gloucester way of talking.
Right. Can you tell us just briefly one? I'm thinking of Howard Blackburn, who's the
drawing. Howard Blackburn is one of the most famous of the Gloucester stories. I make the distinction in the book between fish tales and Gloucester stories. Fish tales are always exaggerations that make things sound a little better. Gloucester stories always make things sound a little worse. Howard Blackburn was a dorymen, one of the fishermen who used to go out on schooners, and then they would lower these two-man dories, and they would handline, in his case, halibut. And it's just unimaginable to be in a high sea in a little rowboat hauling in a line with 50 halibuts on it. I mean, halibuts are very big, heavy fish.
Right. In fact, T.S. Eliot, some might remember, writes about that. And when the fish were too heavy because they wanted to bring back as many as they could, these open-decked rowboats, these dories, would just sink. And he, T.S. Eliot, wrote that they were swallowed in an invisible dark throat.
Yes, yeah, in one of the quartets.
Oh,
they also, by the way, in the wasteland, there is a long passage about Gloucester that was cut by Ezra Pound. The New York Public Library has the original manuscript with Pound's notations, and he's just slashed out all of the parts about Gloucester, which is, you know, that's another Gloucester story.
Right.
It would have been the most famous thing ever written about Gloucester.
Right. But I interrupted you. You're telling us about Howard Blackburn. Go ahead.
Yeah. So he was out halibuting with his dory mate, and a snowstorm came up, and he couldn't find the ship. And when he finally was able to see the lantern, it was a long way away, and the tides were running the other way, and they couldn't get to it. And they decided that the only thing to do was to row to the nearest land, which was Newfoundland, 100 miles away. So they rowed, and his dory froze to death, and he felt his hands were freezing, and he wrapped them around the oars in rowing position so he could keep rowing. Mm. And he made it to Newfoundland and lost all of his fingers and most of his toes. And you would have thought that after that you wouldn't want to go to sea anymore, but he would have specially designed vessels for his fingerless hands, and he broke the one-man Gloucester to Lisbon sailing record, and he rode the entire coastline of Florida, did all these things. He ended up with a bar in Gloucester, and there's still some old-timers around who remember how he used to like to give candy out to kids, and, you know, they wanted the candy, but they were always kind of afraid to take it from his hand because it was scary. Right. He didn't have any fingers.
Right. That is so Gloucester. That is such a Gloucester story.
That is.
But then what happened? Because as people who live here know, and as you describe it, the one thing people in Gloucester would never want to be is one of those, well, let's face it, touristy former fishing towns that we have all over the East Coast, where you might have a red-painted shanty here and there, but nobody really fishes anymore, and they're quaint, and people come and take pictures. This was it was their biggest fear. And it's,
yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, they're surrounded by this, and Gloucester is still miraculously one of the 10 largest fishing ports in America.
In Rockport, Massachusetts, right next to Gloucester, the fishing shack that everyone paints there is kept up by the town because there hasn't been a fisherman in it in decades.
That's right, and it actually collapsed and was rebuilt, known in the art world as Motif Number 1, and it exists for the sole purpose of artists painting it. Rockport painters now go over to Gloucester to find something to paint.
Well, you write that the story of the decline of fishing in Gloucester is both simple. Overfishing of stocks depleted those stocks, but it's also complicated. Fish stocks are killed off by worms that live in seals. Seals have taken up residence in nearby Cape Cod to the delight of the tourism industry there. So what happens next for America's oldest fishing port? We'll have more with author Mark Kurlansky. Also later, John McCain's campaign to woo evangelicals. Back in a minute. We're back with more from author Mark Kurlansky. His new book, The Last Fish Tale, tells the story of Gloucester, Massachusetts, America's oldest fishing port, in severe economic decline because of depleted fishing stocks. There have been government assistance programs, but also new laws that regulate a catch size. Fishermen now call into regulators when they leave the dock. Sometimes monitors travel on board with them, or electronic devices monitor boat movement. The fishermen have to report their catch. They have to throw back overcatch, even if the fish are dead, and they arrange for officials to meet them at the dock. Most have been forced out of fishing. In fact, a 2006 study by Project Bread showed that the number of families in Gloucester that skipped meals because they can't afford food tripled in the last 3 years. And Mark, you traveled the world and found other fishing villages aren't even selling fish anymore, in places like Newfoundland, for instance.
This is a curious thing. I found this in a number of places where there was a fish that was such an icon of the culture, and the fish had now been destroyed, and that fishery no longer existed, and they were selling the fish to tourists in chocolate form. In Newfoundland, they sell chocolate codfish, but in Basque Country, where the anchovies have been wiped out from the Bay of Biscay, they sell chocolate anchovies.
And yet you also found the French Basque fishing village of Saint-Jean-de-Luz surviving, barely, because the fishing fleet is kept away from tourists. On one side of town, there are shops and restaurants. On the other, officials have segregated the fishing fleet. They discourage tourists from going and gawking at the early morning fish auction. And that helped. It's almost like they treat the fishing community like an endangered species and kind of rope them off.
Yeah, well, tourism and fishing, on the face of things, seem compatible, but they end up competing for space, and the problem is that there's more money in tourism. Once you have, for example, once you have yachts paying tremendous prices for mooring, commercial fishermen can no longer afford to moor in that harbor.
Or if you look at harbor space, if you put up a $1 million hotel, as you write, well, someone who's selling ice for fish can't compete with that.
Right, or the general price of real estate, so that, you know, fishermen on Cape Cod or Nantucket can no longer afford to live there. I write a lot about Newlyn in Cornwall, which is in many ways like Gloucester.
This is Newlyn, England.
In Cornwall, yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's on this peninsula of traditional fishing where it's the last holdout and everything around it has become completely about tourism and, you know, in this one sort of tough place it still remains a fishing place. You know, this is something that is happening to fisheries all over the world, and you know, this way of life is very much in danger, and it's a unique culture and an important part of American culture that we would be the less for if we lost.
Well, and they had a suspicion. I mean, you trace the history of the sort of nervousness about the fish stock, and you found an article in a 1911 Gloucester Times that said, "This is the greatest menace to the future of fisheries and the greatest danger the fisheries have ever faced along this coast, which is that trawlers, which came around in the 1890s, were taking too many fish and damaging the ocean floor." And they knew that. They were line fishermen, right, in Gloucester?
That's right. The North Sea developed stern trawling, what we call in New England bottom dragging, and you can look at the history of it and see an exact correlation. It began in the North Sea, in the southern North Sea in the 1880s, and by the 1890s, the southern North Sea had a decline in fish stocks. They moved to the northern part of the North Sea. British fishermen, Cornish and Scottish fishermen, were protesting this, and when it arrived in Gloucester in 1911, there was this huge article in the Gloucester Times saying, talking about fishermen meeting and petitioning Congress to ban stern trawling. And they were saying that it destroys the bottom, it takes too many young fish, it takes too many fish. They gave the whole history of how this had happened in Britain, and we shouldn't let this happen here. And it warned that making fishermen throw back fish was not going to solve the problem, and that if they didn't stop this fishing technique now, before a lot of money was invested in buying these big draggers, that it would be very hard to stop.
Well, Mark Kurlansky, what do you think the future of Gloucester is? Do you think it will be able to fight off that tax base that comes with summer people building big homes on the beaches and hotels coming? Will it become the new Nantucket, or will it be able to hold on to its fishing?
Well, all I can say is that given the character of Gloucester people and given their determination to preserve things, there's a lot of reason to hope that they will be successful. No guarantees in this life.
You begin the book with a ritual that's still performed in Gloucester. It's the greased pole walking. What does it mean?
It came from Sicily. It goes back to about the 14th century there, and it was originally a test of mast climbing skill where you climbed vertically up a greased mast. What it has become in Gloucester is a horizontal pole with about a 6-inch layer of what looks like Crisco, and you walk out about 40 feet, a couple of stories above the water, and you try to grab a flag that is on the end, and the person who gets the flag wins. But what is very Gloucester about this is that, you know, you get hurt either way. whether you get the flag or you don't get the flag, you're going down, you're crashing into the water, very cold sea in June.
But what is it? What does it do for the town that they have this event?
Well, it's part of their annual St. Peter's Festival. St. Peter was a fisherman, and he's a patron saint of fishermen and kind of a patron saint of blue-collar people. And this is part of their annual festival, which involves parading of a statue of St. Peter and some musical religious traditions that are quite beautiful. And this crazy pole walking thing where these guys, you know, are offered free drinks in all the downtown bars and get not only very drunk, but all the Sicilian families have them over for pasta. So they're absolutely, I mean, it's a whole new look at loading for carbs, you know.
Well, then it seems to sort of underscore, you know, we may not be fishing as much as we'd like to be, but they're still what? Still risking, still fierce.
Yeah, I think it says, you know, we're still Gloucester and, you know, life is tough and we're still here.
Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And they just celebrated their St. Peter's Festival up in Gloucester, Massachusetts this past weekend, despite the economic downturn there. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, call it a rock concert, call it performance art, just don't call the Tony-winning production Passing Strange a Broadway musical. We'll speak with the star, Stu. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Senator John McCain goes to the mountain, the mountaintop retreat of the Reverend Billy Graham. After the news, Here and Now. Senator John McCain travels to Colombia and Mexico this week to try to draw attention to his foreign policy credentials. The foreign trip follows a flurry of domestic efforts by the presumptive Republican presidential nominee to win the support of skeptical social conservatives and evangelicals. McCain traveled to the North Carolina mountaintop retreat of the Reverend Billy Graham yesterday and met there privately with Graham and his son Franklin Graham. Well, we thought we'd check in on the McCain campaign. Peter Walston of the Los Angeles Times has been following it. He joins us from Washington. And Peter, a quick look back first. Many headlines made a big deal today about the fact that there was no endorsement from the Grahams yesterday. Do you find that unusual?
Well, no. The Grahams have tried to at least appear bipartisan when they can. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, who now kind of runs the ministry, met in Chicago with Senator Obama, the Democratic nominee. And that was part of a much larger meeting where Senator Obama sat down with about 30 evangelical leaders. But nevertheless, Franklin Graham was there. And so we'll see the Grahams probably try to appear bipartisan.
More ecumenical, maybe, than
right.
other ministers. But it was unusual, some would say, for McCain, who usually takes a break from campaigning on Sunday, to fly from Louisville, Kentucky to Asheville, North Carolina, and then drive for an hour, over an hour, to get to this retreat. What do you read into that?
Well, Senator McCain is anxious and eager to get all of the symbolic help he can get. This is a community that was really support evangelical voters and leaders, at least, were very supportive of President Bush in 2000 and 2004, and frankly, really critical to his success. I mean, in Ohio, they were really the heart and soul of President Bush's Get Out the Vote effort for his reelection campaign in 2004 that won that state, and it was a close election there, so they were crucial. McCain knows that he needs those people, and this is all part of the symbolism. That picture there of him with the Grahams could be hugely symbolic and very important as the campaign progresses. So it was probably worth the extra few hours of travel time.
Well, McCain made another pilgrimage a few years back. We remember when he donned a robe and he spoke at Jerry Falwell's university. And at that time, it was seen by his supporters because they perceived him as a more moderate. It was seen as groveling. His detractors saw it as John McCain faking it. What is evangelicals' dislike of John McCain?
It goes back to 2000 when he really took them on. He basically used them as a way to show his streak as a maverick, which is the old cliche now for John McCain, but that was one tool that he used to show his independence from the Republican Party base, to show that he was different. Well, now it turns out that he's the nominee and he needs them in order to win. At least his campaign believes they need the evangelical vote. And some of the key leaders in the movement in Washington have been battling John McCain for a number of years. Interestingly enough, John McCain actually writes in his own memoir about how when he defended the nomination of John Tower as defense secretary under the first President Bush, it was actually some of the top evangelical leaders in Washington that tried to shoot down the Tower nomination, and McCain went to war with them. So some of these tensions go back years and years. So there's a lot of pain there, and John McCain is really doing everything he can to make up for that as quickly as he can.
Well, and how is that working for him? Because we're reminded John McCain was raised an Episcopalian. He befriended two prominent evangelical leaders in this last campaign and then had to disavow both of them. That's John Hagee and Rod Parsley after they made controversial statements. As an observer, does he seem comfortable?
I'd say the results are mixed. It's hard to say whether he seems comfortable. Last week, before his private meeting with the Grahams, he was in Ohio and met with some of the evangelical and social conservative leaders in that state. I had been there several weeks ago and interviewed a number of them and wrote a story about how they just don't trust him. And in fact, some of the attempts to reach out to them by the campaign had really not gone well. So here was John McCain in Ohio trying to make peace. And he, by the reports I got from that private meeting, impressed them. Not because he was necessarily pandering to them, although he did say some of what they wanted to hear. He talked about how much he's opposed to gay marriage, for instance. Now, several of them told me that they're still not convinced they're going to go to the mat for him the way they did for Bush in 2004.
Well, and they've told you that he may be charming in these private meetings, but they want him to come out publicly and speak out about issues. He has been against gay marriage. He's been pro-life, very much against Roe v. Wade. He's talked about appointing judges that might overturn Roe v. Wade. So where's the disconnect? What is he not saying?
The concern among the evangelical leaders I've talked to is that John McCain, they know that John McCain is a different kind of Republican. He is somebody who, in order to win, probably needs to appeal to the middle, to the mainstream moderates, maybe conservative Democrats, what some have called in the past Reagan Democrats. Those are people who sometimes are not attracted to the evangelical message. So there's a concern that John McCain is willing to talk to some of these folks in private, but then publicly doesn't want to embrace them. So that continues to feed the idea that John McCain only wants to use them to win the election and won't give them what they want once he's in office. And to a certain extent, there's some truth to that. John McCain does need the middle in order to win this election. He is not running the same strategy that Bush ran in 2004, at least. This is not about the Republican base for John McCain. It's about the base plus the middle. So the evangelical leaders wonder how much can they really trust him if he's not willing to fully embrace them. So they asked him in that private meeting, they told him that he needs to publicly embrace them, to talk about the issues they care about. They really want him to go out and give speeches about gay marriage. So what happened after the meeting? John McCain's campaign put out a statement endorsing the Proposition 8 in California, the initiative drive there to ban gay marriage in California. He didn't really talk about it that much, but he put out a statement. Is that going to be enough? We'll have to see.
Well, meanwhile, John McCain heads off to Colombia and Mexico. Your colleague Mark Barabak in the LA Times writes, not since Richard Nixon traveled to all 50 states in 1960 has a candidate followed an itinerary that appears so at odds with his political needs. Why is he going to Colombia when there are, you know, so many questions about his domestic agenda?
One could argue that another group that McCain needs to appeal to here is Latino voters. There's a lot of actually Colombian Americans in Florida who vote, so perhaps that could help. There's also the huge populations of Mexican Americans. John McCain thinks he can dig into that traditionally Democratic, mostly Democratic constituency. So going to Mexico, the images that will be beamed back to Latino voters in Colorado and New Mexico and Nevada and Florida, that could be beneficial as well.
Could it backfire in that, you know, conservatives are very angry at John McCain for his call for immigration reform?
Yes, and you know, this seems to be the running theme of the McCain campaign, the challenge that he's constantly facing in the base versus the middle. It's the challenge he has with the evangelicals and the same with the Latino voters on the issue of immigration. You know, John McCain, on the one hand, is this different kind of Republican with a broader appeal than President Bush, but on the other hand, he can't win without the base, just as President Bush couldn't win without the base. So this is the challenge of John McCain's campaign, and whether it's the Latino voters on the issue of immigration or evangelical voters and some of the social issues, John McCain seems to still be trying to feel his way through these challenges. And every time I talk to voters in these different constituencies, all I hear is frustration.
Peter Walston of the Los Angeles Times on the John McCain campaign. Peter, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, Carlo Petrini, founder of the Slow Food Movement. You're listening to Here and Now. In U.S. Olympic swimming trials in Omaha today, swimmers are jockeying for world records. Yesterday, swimmers Michael Phelps and Katie Hoffs set world records in the 400-meter men's and women's individual medleys. And at the track and field championship in Eugene, Oregon last night, Tyson Gay ran the 100-meter dash in 9.68 seconds. As his coach said, this dude needs some re-entry glasses. We need to get him some kind of flame-retardant uniform in case he catches on fire. Boston Globe sports reporter Shira Springer joins us. Shira, just how fast was Tyson Gay?
Extraordinarily fast. I mean, obviously, this is the fastest anyone has ever run 100 meters. Even though it was wind-aided, it is still remarkable that he's in that 9.6-second range. The man who ran it fast before him, the previous fastest time, was 9.69, but that was at altitude with a much stronger tailwind.
Well, Shira, help us understand the wind aspect, because as you said, somebody has run 9.69 seconds. The world record is 9.72. That was set by the Jamaican Usain Bolt. And here we have Tyson Gay running 9.68, but it wasn't a world record because of the tailwind?
Correct. In track and field, 2.0 meters per second, wind of 2.0 meters per second is legally allowable. Tyson Gay yesterday had a tailwind of 4.1 meters per second, which is basically the equivalent of 9.5 miles per hour. It's too strong of a wind to make it the time count for a world record, but it shouldn't diminish the accomplishment.
Well, tell us about Tyson Gay. He already has more than $2 million in endorsements. You know, we hear that his squeaky clean image is what advertisers are drawn to. But is he going to be able to live up to the expectations of Americans, you know, of not just being an Olympic great, but also entertaining?
Well, that's an interesting question. Before yesterday, many people looked to the Jamaicans, Usain Bolt and his teammate Asafa Powell, as sort of the dominant and best sprinters, 100-meter sprinters in the world. Tyson Gay was sort of seen as someone who needed to catch up, but with this performance yesterday, he certainly asserted himself on the track once again, and he looks to be in that contention for the gold medal. As far as personality is concerned, Tyson is probably not what most people would expect from a 100-meter runner. He is often soft-spoken when you speak to him after races. He is very, very detailed about how his race went, what he could do better, breaks it down very well. I think in America we're sort of used to this sort of all-out, in-your-face personality. I wouldn't describe Tyson Gay in that way, but maybe that's a good thing, because as we know what's happened in the sprints, we've had these very big, outsized personalities, and they haven't been clean track and field athletes. You know, the sport, particularly the sprints, has been tainted since the last Olympics by steroid use.
Well, you remind us that track star Marion Jones admitted to steroid use, and she's now serving time.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You saw how small the world of track and field is yesterday, because Marion Jones' current husband is Obadiah Thompson, and he was the one who, prior to Tyson Gay, had run that 9.69, the previous fastest time ever. So the specter of steroid use is always very close to the track and field community, even when you're dealing with a perfectly clean athlete like Tyson Gay. So not only does Tyson Gay have to perform well on the track, but he has to uphold this pristine image.
Well, and we've got that $2 million in endorsements, and it seems like a lot on the back of one young man. And did he, in one of the runs, miss the finish line?
He misjudged the finish line. I mean, that was the amazing thing about this whole weekend. It's sort of been a roller coaster ride for Tyson Gay in some ways, because in his very first qualifying race, he mistook a white line that falls about 10 meters before the actual finish for the finish line. He eased up and nearly didn't qualify for the quarterfinals.
Well, Shira, look ahead for us. Tyson Gay, one more race. He's supposed to run the 200 meters, but was his coach kidding? Will he need to rest? How is he going to do?
Well, that's the big question at this point. I mean, how will Tyson Gay recover from running a 9.68? We'll see very quickly in the qualifying rounds, which start, I believe, Friday, whether or not his body has recovered sufficiently. It would be a big blow for the U.S. team if Tyson Gay were unable to make the team in both the 100 and 200.
Shira Springer of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Anne of Green Gables, the beloved 11-year-old, turns 100 this month. Wait till you hear how people celebrate in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Ann! Coming, Mrs. Hammond! Ann! Ann, Shirley, get in here this instant!
This month marks the 100th anniversary of Canadian author Lucy Maud Montgomery's classic Anne of Green Gables. In that scene from one of the many film adaptations, poor Anne was late for her babysitting job. You remember Anne, the feisty orphan who was taken in by a brother and sister, Marilla and Matthew Cuthbert, who were expecting a boy from the orphanage to help them on their farm. Instead, the local train brings an overly chatty, red-haired 11-year-old girl who would rather read poetry than do chores. The book was set in Canada's Prince Edward Island town of Cavendish, and the island has been at the center of the anniversary celebrations. There are Anne parades and Anne Country Fair. But why is Anne of Green Gables so revered in Japan, where you can actually buy a house of Green Gables? In Poland, where there's a traditional picnic with carrot juice in honor of Anne's red hair? Elizabeth Epperly is the author of Imagining Anne, the Island Scrapbooks of L.M. Montgomery. She's also founder of the L.M. Montgomery Institute at the University of Prince Edward Island. Dr. Epperly, let's start with Japan. I mean, we understand one of the reasons Anne is so embraced there is that right after World War II, there were so many orphans, and they related to Anne's orphan experience. But in the books, we also see Anne grow up. She's given an opportunity to leave the island, but instead stays to take care of her aging adoptive parents. So she shows sacrifice as well.
That's right. There's sacrifice involved in that, and that was part of the appeal in Japan, certainly. And the kinship of islands. So between Japan and Prince Edward Island, one place impossibly distant in a way. And the character with red hair and gray-green eyes, I mean, this is an impossibility in Japan itself. So you think about that exotic kind of twinning, too.
Well, there's now a school of social work and nursing called the School of Green Gables in Japan. There's an Anne musical opening in Tokyo later this year. Anne Shirley, her name was Anne Shirley, postal stamps. And Japanese flock to Prince Edward Island to get married, we understand?
Oh, they do, yes. And they come to the McNeil Homestead in Cavendish because they want to see the actual tree that Montgomery looked at while she was writing, the apple tree at their place. They come here in great numbers.
We understand the book made its way to Japan through a Christian missionary. It was secretly translated as part of a way of introducing role models for young Japanese girls.
That is correct. And they were also looking for something Western and upbeat at the end of the war.
Well, that's Japan. Why does Anne of Green Gables resonate in Poland?
Montgomery was actually part of the black market in Poland. I mean, they used her books on the black market when it was behind the Iron Curtain because they see in Montgomery's writing this passion for homeland. So they actually see Montgomery as nationalistic, and they want their own people to reflect that and to admire that.
Well, let's listen to a little more of one of the film adaptations. Again, this one's from 1986, and this is when Anne meets her foster mother, the stern Marilla Cuthbert, who asks Anne her name.
What's your name?
Would you please call me Cordelia?
Call you Cordelia?
Don't you think it's a pretty name?
Is that your name?
Well, no, it's not exactly my name, but oh, I would love to be called Cordelia.
I don't understand what you mean.
Cordelia is a perfectly elegant name.
What is your name, child, and no more nonsense?
Anne Shirley. Plain old unromantic Anne Shirley.
It sounds Dickensian, at least initially, but she cares very much for them, Anne does. She cares very much for her new parents. But we heard there, it's sort of a complete mismatch. She has this wild imagination. She dreams she's beautiful, that she has brown hair instead of red hair. How does that dreaming resonate?
What's so wonderful about that mismatch, as you call it, between Marilla and Anne, actually turns out to be a profound matching and a complementing of forces. And I think that this is part of the appeal of the book, that Marilla is that part in all of us that's very judgmental and narrow and rule-bound. And there's Anne bursting through all of that, and Anne wins.
How Canadian is that?
That's very Canadian and very Scottish Presbyterian, which was Montgomery's own background, and that's Marilla's background, that very strict upbringing, and that's the environment that Anne comes into. And so she couldn't find a better background against which to rebel.
We know that Lucy Maud Montgomery, the author, her mother died when she was a toddler. Her father later moved away. She was raised by grandparents. Is she Anne?
Well, certainly in aspects of her, she said, I am not Anne. And yet the imagination, that love of nature, her love of clothing, that love of woodland flowers and bouquets, all of the shapes and colors of her own life you find in Anne. So it's correct to say that certainly Montgomery understood Anne inside out.
Well, and we talked about the power of Anne on people. How about you? I mean, this sounds astonishing, but do we understand you were born American, moved to Canada just so you could connect with Montgomery's writing about Anne of Green Gables?
That's correct. My grandfather read Anne of Green Gables to my father, and my father read it to me, and I fell in love with Prince Edward Island and certainly with Anne, and I was away at boarding school for high school when we were supposed to be applying to universities, and so my parents didn't know that the only place I applied was Prince of Wales College, where Montgomery had gone, because I wanted to see what Prince Edward Island was like when the tourists had left. Thank goodness my father was very indulged me in this, and he drove me up early to the university because we found out that Prince of Wales College ceased to exist that summer in 1969, and it amalgamated with St. Dunstan's University and created the University of Prince Edward Island. So not only did I come up from Virginia, but I was the first student to register at the newly created University of Prince Edward Island in the fall of 1969.
Where you have now founded and are first chair of the L.M. Montgomery Institute, which,
yes.
I mean, what was the draw for you?
I loved the character of Anne. Of course, I liked her flamboyance. I liked it that she could get away with having a temper. But I loved the colors. And what was interesting about this, I didn't really understand when I was 5 years old, that my father would read these color-drenched descriptions to us. And he would stop and he'd say, "Isn't that beautiful? Can't you see that?" But my father was colorblind. And so I found this so remarkable. The color of this appealed to a man who couldn't see color. And I thought, wow, there's really something in this.
Doctor, can you give us a couple of sentences, an example of what you mean by the color-drenched writing?
Yes. When Anne first is riding with Matthew in the buggy and they're coming from Bright River Station, she actually sees the Lake of Shining Waters, and she describes that in hues of pink and gold and crocus, in a whole range of flower imagery, as well as a palette that I'd never even heard of.
You now serve on the board of the Anne of Green Gables Licensing Authority.
That is correct.
What is the weirdest thing you've turned down?
Oh, that's a hard one. I would say mud patties with braids.
Mud patties?
Mud patties with braids, and this is Anne's Land with braids.
You mean people wanted to sell some of Prince Edward Island?
People wanted to sell those, and they wanted to be able to use the Anne name.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I know there's even a conference marking this 100th anniversary. What kind of scholarship is represented at a conference like that?
You would be amazed by this. There are 12 different countries represented, 40 different presentations, going from a topic like this, teaching Anne and Islamic Iran, because the students in Iran had heard about Anne of Green Gables, and they wanted to use that as a way to learn English.
Isn't that interesting?
Another one, Anne at Hogwarts. What happens when you put Harry Potter and Anne of Green Gables together? Imagine the world then.
Hilarity ensues.
Hilarity ensues. Cracking the female code in Avonlea and River Heights, Anne Shirley and Nancy Drew's acquisition of power through language. How's that?
Isn't that something? Who knew? That's Dr. Elizabeth Epperly. She's author of Imagining Anne, the Island Scrapbooks of L.M. Montgomery. She's founded the L.M. Montgomery Institute at the University of Prince Edward Island. And L.M. Montgomery, of course, Lucy Maud Montgomery, author of Anne of Green Gables, which is celebrating 100 years. Dr. Epperly, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.